Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. In coordination with the Science and Technology Forum, we organize tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences, and everyone can visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my great pleasure to introduce famous Berkeley astrophysicist Alex Filipenko, who's going to talk about Comet Ison, the brightest or predicted to be one of the brightest comets in a long time. Professor Filipenko.
Well, thank you very much, George. It's a pleasure to be here to tell you about the possible comet of the century, or not. We'll see. That's one of the things that makes comets fun. I spoke earlier to the Commonwealth Club, I believe, last February on the expanding universe, the accelerating expansion of the universe. So it's a pleasure to be back here again. So what are comets? Well, comets are diffuse balls of light with a long tail like this that slowly move among the stars in the night sky from night to night. All right? And they have different appearances. The previous one you saw was Comet West. Here's Comet Yakutake, 1996. Did any of you see Yakutake? Okay, very good. What about Hale-Bopp, 97? That was a beauty. That's right. That one lasted much longer and was really quite bright, so quite a few people saw it. That's the last bright one we've had in the Northern Hemisphere that was easily visible in the night sky. Here's one, McNaught, 2007. Although it was briefly visible in the Northern Hemisphere night skies, it was mostly spectacular in the Southern Hemisphere. It just wasn't well placed for viewing in the Northern Hemisphere. So these things last for a few days, weeks, in a few cases, some months. They move slowly across the sky. They are different from a meteor. A meteor is not a comet. A meteor, commonly called a shooting star or a falling star, is just a little pebble or a grain of sand moving at many, many miles per second, intersecting the Earth's atmosphere and essentially burning up, compressing the air in front of it, heating that air up, and then vaporizing in the process. Those last a fraction of a second or a few seconds. They are often mistaken for comets, but they are not comets. Here's a nice comet, Comet Ikeyasaki, 1965. Comet comes from the Greek for long-haired star, Aster Cometis, in fact. And you can see how the ancients may have thought of these things as fuzzy stars with long hair. Their physical nature and origin was not yet known. I'll tell you about that. But that's what they were called. And in ancient cultures, comets were widely viewed as bad omens, harbingers of doom, messengers from the gods telling of impending doom. And this theme you can see over and over again, indeed, in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Calphurnia tells Caesar, when beggars die, there are no comets seen. The heavens themselves blaze forth the death of princes, you know. So, that's a pretty bad omen if there's a comet and you're a king and you've got a son or a daughter. So anyway, we now know that in general, they're nothing to be feared, except if they crash into us, in which case they are something to be feared. Physically, what is a comet? It's essentially a dirty snowball or a snowy dirt ball, depending on how much of a mixture of ice and snow versus rocks and dust particles and grit there is, all right? A ball of rock, dust, and ice that comes from the outer reaches of the solar system. And by ice, I mean not just water ice, but carbon dioxide, ammonia, methane, all kinds of frozen gases that we call ices. They come from the outer solar system, and as they approach the sun, the sunlight warms them, and the ices sublimate. They vaporize directly into gas. They don't go into the liquid state. You can call it evaporation, but technically the word is sublimation or vaporization. So the sun's light warms the thing, it starts evaporating or sublimating, and then the sun's light and also charged particles from the sun push on the gases that have been released and on the dust particles that have been released. And those gases and dust particles reflect the sunlight and glow. So here you have, I hope, an animation from SOHO, the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, actually a set of photographs, showing the disk of the sun here being blocked or occulted by a screen that blocks out the sun's bright light. Here you can see the sun's corona, these energetic charged particles that are flowing out from the sun. In fact, just a week and a half ago, I saw a total solar eclipse off the west coast of Africa, and the moon occasionally naturally blocks off the sun's bright disk like this and allows you to see the corona. Anyway, the corona consists of these energetic gases flowing out, and it's those gases that also impinge upon the particles of dust and the molecules of ices of gas that have evaporated out and push away and form the comet's tail. Now here you can actually see two comets there, one and two, coming in. These are comets that actually got gobbled up by the sun. They passed so close to the sun that they entered the sun or evaporated and disintegrated before entering the sun. So they didn't make it out the other side. We can see from studies of relatively nearby comets that are known to come around every once in a while, in the case of Halley's Comet, every 76 years or so we know when it's coming. We can send spacecraft out to study them. And the spacecraft have confirmed this icy dirt ball or dirty ice ball picture. Here you can see this peanut-shaped nucleus of Halley's Comet. It's about 16 kilometers along its longest side here. It's thinner. And here's the sun-facing side, and you can see that the heated, the illuminated side is indeed sublimating. The gas is initially squirted out toward the sun, but then the sun's radiation pressure, the pressure from the light and the pressure also from the charged particles, pushes these gases back. You can't see that in this photograph, but that's what happens. So, in fact, a comet's tail, most of the tail, points away from the sun. Now, you might think, sure, it points away from the sun because as it's moving, you know, the friction of the gas particles against other gas particles in the solar system pushes back the tail, kind of like Fabio with his long hair running quickly and the hair flowing backward. That's not what's happening. It's not that the friction against the interplanetary dust and particles is what's pushing the tail back. It's the solar wind and the radiation pressure, the light from the sun that's pushing it back. And that means that even on its outward journey, the tail faces away from the sun. So here in this case, you see that the tail, in a sense, leads the head. And that tells you right off the bat that the Fabio picture must be wrong. Anyway, they spend their time way out here where they don't have a tail because they're in the icy freezer of the solar system. As they get closer, they speed up, by the way, because gravity becomes stronger. They develop this tail, and then the tail becomes shorter and shorter as the thing enters the deep freeze again. And here you can see a pair of photographs that shows you that the motion of the comet is not necessarily in the same direction as the tail. Here you can see the tails, there are two tails, and the motion of the comet from one day to a few days later is essentially perpendicular to the tails. So the sun is down here somewhere, it's below the screen. Okay, well you notice there were two tails. Here's a color photograph of Comet Hale-Bopp. Turns out that there's a dust tail, that's mostly fine particulate matter. It's the grit that's released from this dirty ice ball. And it reflects sunlight, and so it has kind of a whitish-yellow appearance. And it's curved. You can see it's kind of curved like this. And in this diagram, you can see it's curved. That's because when the dust particles get shot out from the comet, they are at a greater distance from the sun, and so they take on a slower orbit, being farther from the sun. Gravity isn't acting as strong, and so they sort of fall behind, and this gives the dust tail a curved appearance. But there's also this blue so-called ion or gas tail. That's produced by glowing molecules or atoms of gas. They're shot out very quickly from the comet because they have low mass, and so the pressure on them moves them very much more quickly. They're shot out in a pretty much a straight line away from the direction of the sun, and they don't take on a curved appearance because they move out so quickly, and by the time they're a day or two out, they've faded, and so there hasn't been enough time to take on a curved appearance, whereas these dust particles last for a long time, several weeks, and it can take on a curved appearance. This bluish color comes from the fact that the molecules sort of fluoresce. They've been hit by ultraviolet radiation from the sun, and that then gets converted into visible light, often of a bluish color. Now, Hale-Bopp had both a nice dust tail and an ion tail. Here you can see Comet McNaught. It was, at least at this time, mostly a dust tail. Here's this beautiful curved dust tail, little tiny ion tail right there. But Comet Yakutake right here, at least at this time, had a mostly gas or ion tail and not much of a visible dust tail. So it seems to have consisted more of ices, less of particles of grit. Well, I mentioned that comets come from the deep freeze of the solar system. Let me be a little bit more specific. They come from a region out beyond Neptune called the Kuiper Belt. It's the region that Pluto inhabits. And indeed, Pluto is just one of the largest Kuiper Belt objects. It doesn't really qualify as a planet because it's not big enough. It's not big enough to have cleared its area of other things. There are lots and lots of friends, and so that's why it was demoted a while ago. By the way, that's a strength of science. We're not wedded to old ideas. As new data are gathered, as new evidence comes to light, we are willing to change our minds about things. And that's a strength of science, not a weakness, of course. And I don't really need to tell you here that, but it's amazing how many people think that that's a weakness. Anyway, they're out here. They formed long, long ago. And they also come from an even larger region known as the scattered disk that sort of forms a donut, a distant donut around the sun. All right. There's also an even bigger region called the Oort cloud. Now, the Kuiper Belt is this little blue thing way down in here, and the Oort cloud is a much, much bigger, roughly spherical distribution of these balls of ice. And the importance of comets is that they formed long ago when the solar system was forming, 4.5 billion years ago. They probably formed in the vicinity of the giant planets, Jupiter and Saturn, and then they were flung out there to these great depths of space, either the Oort cloud or the Kuiper Belt or the scattered disk. They were flung there early on before they had a chance to form planets. Now, some of them did get gobbled up by Jupiter, but the point is those that didn't get gobbled up got flung out gravitationally into these distant regions. And occasionally they get nudged, either by a passing star or gravitational interactions among them, nudge them either out of the solar system or inward toward the sun. And those that go toward the sun heat up, sublimate, and form this tail. And we can study them. But the importance is that they represent primitive material out of which the solar system was made. There is very little, if any, such primitive material here on Earth. It's been processed over and over again over billions of years. Sedimentation, you know, eruption through volcanoes, weathering processes, process called differentiation, which is where when the Earth was molten, the dense things sank to the middle. That's why the iron core of the Earth is in the middle. So the Earth's material has been processed and reprocessed many, many times over billions of years. It's no longer primitive. It's hard to learn about the early solar system from studies of materials on Earth. But comets represent this primitive material whose study can shed light on the early history and formation of our solar system. So that's the scientific importance of comets. All right. Well, let me now tell you a little bit about this one that's coming very, very soon. And in fact, George asked me to give this talk because this has been sort of a news item this past year, and he wanted to hear all about it. Comet Ison, more formally 2012 S1. What in the world does that terminology mean? It was the first comet found in the first half of September. The 1 stands for the first comet. The S does not stand for September. S stands for the first half of September, where the first half of January is A, the second half of January is B, the first half of February is C, and so on. Pretty crazy nomenclature. Now, if you go through that exercise, you will realize that the first half of September does not correspond to S. It corresponds to R. But turns out they skip I along the way. So there you go. Okay, 2012 S1. More popularly known as Comet Ison. Why is it called Comet Ison? Well, it was actually discovered by these two gentlemen, Vitaly Nevsky and Artsom Novichinok, in Russia. And they are amateur astronomers who are part of this network called the International Scientific Optical Network, ISON. And this is a whole network of relatively small telescopes with which they and others are scanning the skies, trying to find asteroids, which are mostly rocky bodies in our solar system, mostly between Jupiter and Mars, but some of them have orbits that occasionally cross the orbit of the Earth. And the point is, we want to find these things decades in advance before they hit the Earth, so that we can do something about it and not go the way of the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. Right? If you detect these things decades ahead of time, then clever physicists and engineers can send something up there to deflect them. Anyway, astronomers will someday save humanity, so, you know. Anyway, they were looking for asteroids, and on September 21st, 2012, they took a series of images that showed an object that appeared to be moving ever so slightly, that thing there. And the quality of the night wasn't that great, and their telescope is pretty small, so they could not tell whether this was an asteroid or a comet, but they announced it as one of the two, and within 24 hours, much better data were taken, and some fuzz was seen, and it was deemed a comet. But because they did not, in their discovery telegram, say whether it was an asteroid or a comet, they, in my opinion, were robbed of the name. Comets are normally named after their discoverer. Hale-Bopp, Yakutake, West, Ikeyasaki. You know, you've seen the pattern. Okay, why isn't this thing Nevsky Novichinok, other than that's nearly unpronounceable? Okay, it's Ison. And I feel they were robbed. It's Ison because it's named after the network. But they, in my opinion, were robbed in that they were simply, you know, being honest about how they couldn't quite yet tell whether this was a comet or an asteroid. Nevertheless, they discovered it, so, you know, why not name it after them? Whatever. That's the way it goes. And, of course, this ISON network will surely find other comets in the future, and so they'll have to be known as ISON 2, 3, 4, and so on. Presumably this will be ISON number 1, or the ISON, if it turns into a good thing. Or maybe it'll become a Kahutek-like thing, which I'll tell you about in a minute. Anyway, overnight, this became kind of a sensation. And the reason was that it was faint. Now, this number doesn't necessarily mean anything to you, but it means that it's 100,000 times fainter than the naked eye stars. And you might think, well, that's pretty faint. But it's beyond Jupiter's orbit at this time. And most comets, when they're beyond Jupiter's orbit, are even fainter than 100,000 times fainter than the eye can see. So this guy was actually bright, given its location. And that suggested that it might be quite a large comet. The other thing that was quickly realized was that on Thanksgiving Day of this year, on November 28th, it'll pass very, very close to the sun, unusually close, less than one solar diameter from the sun's, quote, surface, unquote, the sun has no surface, but it's sort of the layer at which the sun becomes opaque. It's one of these so-called sun-grazing comets. And passing so close to the sun, the sublimation rate should become just absolutely enormous. And the sun's light and the solar wind should push against the gases and the dust particles, forming a beautiful tail that then would reflect sunlight. And so it could turn into a really great comet if it really is that big and, you know, if it sublimates a lot. So Headlines quickly came out, new comet might blaze brighter than the full moon. Well, that statement isn't technically incorrect. I mean, anything. I might be president of the United States, okay? It's unlikely, but sure, anything could be brighter than the full moon. So that's not technically incorrect, but it implies that people will see in the dark night sky, especially since they show Hale Bopp here in the dark night sky, something that's brighter than the full moon. And then here's another one. Newly spotted comet may outshine the full moon. A lot of headlines. You know, these are 25th of September, something like that. You know, this is just days after discovery. And here's one of my favorites. Massive comet to put on spectacular show this Thanksgiving. And here it is, about to hit the Earth, it seems. Yeah, that'll be one spectacular show. I agree. Okay. Well, here's why these headlines were misleading. Yes, if the comet is really big, and so that part is not yet known for sure, and it gets close to the sun, that, you know, the trajectory is quite easy to calculate. Yeah, you know, it could become really, really bright. But that's when it's nearly in a direct sight line toward the sun. That's when it's like one solar diameter away from the sun. You shouldn't be looking at it at that time. I mean, if you insist on looking at it on November 28th, you know, be sure you block the sun with your fist or a building or something. But I'm not telling you to look at it because I don't want you to sue me after you lose your vision, okay? I mean, it'll be hard to see, and it certainly won't be against the dark night sky, all right? And as it pulls away from the sun, it should quickly start fading, both because the evaporation rate goes down and because the distance from the sun increases, therefore the amount of light to reflect decreases, okay? So, yeah, maybe it'll be as bright as the full moon, but that's only when it's in the direction of the sun. And so those headlines were misleading. Here's some more headlines. Brighter than the full moon, the biggest star of 2013 could be Ison, the comet of the century, you know. Well, again, this is based on the assumption that it's a pretty big object. Time magazine at least had a question mark after their headline. But they had the advantage that this, I think, is a month later or something. Does that say October 20th? No, that's December 20th. Oh, well, by that time, there were huge doubts already, at least about the comet of the century issue. And here's why astronomers early on, even in late September, started having their doubts, okay? First of all, it was quite quickly realized that this guy is coming in from the Oort cloud for the very first time. You can tell from its trajectory that it's not like Halley's Comet, which has a 76-year period and is quite close in. This guy is coming from far away. And historically, we have seen that comets that are on their way toward the sun for the first time often have an outer layer of particularly volatile ices, okay? By that, I mean they sublimate easily at a pretty low temperature. So what if, back when the thing was out beyond Jupiter, the most volatile ices sublimated, created a puff of gas around the thing, which then reflected a lot of sunlight, that would make it brighter than one would have expected? That would suggest that it's a bigger object if you don't take that process into account. But if you take it into account, it could be a much, much smaller object that happened to go through one of these puffs. All right, you see? And so estimates were being made as to how big it might be, and in fact, it was estimated that it might only be maybe 5 kilometers across, a far cry from the 40 or 50 of Hale-Bopp. All right? On the other hand, it's still going to pass close to the sun, so the sublimation rate could become really great. That's true. Not all is lost. But on the other hand, still, with that huge sublimation rate, there's a possibility the thing will disintegrate before it even reaches the sun. And then once the material passes the sun, you know, it becomes so dispersed that there's not enough of it reflecting sunlight to be a bright, visible phenomenon in the sun, right? So you want the thing to survive its passage around the sun, but keep on sublimating so as to produce a continuous new supply of gas and dust populating the tail. All right, so people watched to see what would happen. And here's where amateur astronomers continued to make significant contributions. A lot of amateurs made photographs. And indeed, the thing didn't brighten very quickly through January, February, March, April. Just didn't brighten very quickly. It pretty much stayed at the same brightness at which it had been discovered, or maybe a little tiny bit brighter. And then a telescope known as SWIFT made some measurements and determined that its diameter was about 5 kilometers, about 3 miles. So not a very big comet. And Hubble pictures in April confirmed that it was not very big, maybe a couple of miles across. So already, unless something becomes really favorable, it's almost certainly not going to be the comet of the century, because though it's going to pass close to the sun with a large sublimation rate, it's just not a very big comet. It's not 40, 50, 60 kilometers. It's only 5, maybe. All right? Nevertheless, could be good. All right. Then it wasn't visible for about 2.5 months. Its position in the sky was too close to the position of the sun. So in June and July of this year, it was in the constellation Gemini, and that's roughly where the sun is at that time of the year. Well, it reappeared in mid-August. It was photographed by amateur astronomer Bruce Gehry somewhat earlier than people expected. This was quite a tour de force that he was able to get these pictures right before the sun rose. Here it is, the recovery image on August 12th. And it was significantly fainter than expected. So over 2.5 months of not being visible because of the sun, it hadn't brightened very much. All right, well, but you could say it's still pretty far out, and the dominant component, the water ice, has not yet started sublimating yet. It's too far away. Okay? Well, by the end of August, water ice sublimation should have started, all other things being equal, and it stayed pretty faint. There it is, but it is developing a tail. Okay, so it's not a complete fizzler, at least not yet. Okay. September, a month later, tail's getting bigger. Okay, you can see some motion there. This is several frames. So it's developing, and it has not yet disintegrated. And some people said, well, it's such a wimpy comet, by this time it might even disintegrate. A little bit later, October 8th, nice image. By the way, it looks bluish-green here. That's because there's carbon-2 molecules that tend to emit. They get excited by the solar radiation, and then they emit, they fluoresce in the green part of the spectrum. So it's got this nice green thing, plus a dust tail here, a more normal dust tail. Here it is, the 13th of October, developing pretty nicely, but not something spectacular, at least not yet. October 27th, still developing. By the way, stars don't really have points. That's just an artifact of this telescope that was used. And then just the other night, I downloaded this image from November 8th, okay? And it's developing nicely, but it is not yet spectacularly bright. In fact, just this week, people in very clear, dark skies have started detecting it with good pairs of binoculars. But if you go out in the morning sky and look east right now, you will not see it with your naked eye, all right? So here's a plot of brightness. Brightness goes upward this way versus time. And here are a bunch of measurements, these red things. And at a given time, you see there's a wide dispersion in brightness measurements. And that's because it's intrinsically hard to measure the brightness, the total brightness of a fuzzy object, right? Where do you stop? You know, it's just hard to do. But the latest measurements, I just downloaded this today. Okay, they were compiled on November 11th. And there's still a lot of dispersion, but the upper end of the envelope, you see there's some little red points there. If these people are right, then it's brightening significantly. And here's just one illustrative model, all right? By the way, naked eye visibility is magnitude 6 in very clear, dark skies. Okay, so there's magnitude 6. It might become 100 times or so brighter than the faintest thing visible to the naked eye, but that's when it'll be in the direction of the sun. So almost certainly it will not become a naked eye object in the direction of the sun. So probably you shouldn't try seeing it then. But I don't find that yet to be completely discouraging, all right? Because it all depends on what happens once it passes perihelion, its closest approach to the sun. So here it is, November 27th, 28th, 29th, and 30th. Okay, they just go whipping by because they become so close to the sun that the gravity is pulling on them quickly, okay? It all depends on what happens here, if it survives up to here. Because if it survives and it's still there, then all this sunlight and the solar wind will be obliterating the thing. And unless it completely disintegrates, we could have the situation where we've got this ball that's 3 miles in diameter. It's outgassing like there's no tomorrow, letting off a lot of dust and gas. The sunlight and the solar wind then push on the particles and form a beautiful tail that lasts maybe for weeks. That's still a possibility. And as an example, let me show you Comet Lovejoy, 2011. It was not visible well in the northern hemisphere. It was a sun grazer. It was smaller, considerably smaller in size than Comet Ison. It was maybe half a kilometer in diameter, something like that. And yet it became a nice comet in the southern skies after passing perihelion. So Ison, if it does the same thing, could form something more spectacular than this. Don't give up hope. Why is the future so uncertain? It's basically because there are a lot of variables. Unlike the trajectory, which is dictated just by Newton's laws, the appearance of the tail depends on many variables which are uncertain. For example, I already mentioned that this thing might disintegrate before reaching the sun. If it's got the consistency of souffle, then it might not even be able to withstand the sun's heat and solar wind when it's as close as 1 or 2 weeks from the sun. And we're getting close right now, okay? It's now November 13th, and closest passage is in 2 weeks. And it's still going strong as of a few nights ago. So, you know, I don't think it's going to disintegrate, but it might disintegrate a few days before reaching perihelion. Depends a lot on the composition of the thing and the strength. And in fact, some months ago, comet expert John Bortle said the following: Ison has no chance of surviving its perihelion based on my paper, blah, blah, blah. So he said maybe it'll reach perihelion, but it won't survive, okay? And if it doesn't survive, then post-perihelion there won't be much to see because it'll all become too diffuse. You need this continual new source of gas and dust. But in the Astrophysical Journal Letters in the September issue, I found the following article by some comet experts. Given current constraints on Ison's nucleus properties and the typically determined values for these properties among all comets, we find tidal disruption to be unlikely unless other factors affect Ison substantially. By tidal disruption, what they mean is that when the thing is close to the sun's gravity is pulling on the near side more than on the far side. That's what causes tides on Earth. They're caused by the moon pulling on the near side more than on the far side. And here on Earth, that's okay. It's just tides. But if you have too much of a tidal effect like this, it can actually disrupt the object. And that's a danger for this comet as it gets close to and passes perihelion. But these experts say that, in fact, it probably will not get tidally disrupted. Bortle, at least a few months ago, said that it will. You know, so, you know, even the experts disagree. How much gas and dust will be released? Well, that's another uncertain factor. There could be outbursts. There may have been an outburst from the very start when it was discovered in September of 2012. And as a great example of an outburst, let me mention Comet Holmes, which is normally a rather pathetic-looking comet. Astronomers like it because it's got a pretty short period and they can study it much of the time, but it's very faint. Well, on October 23rd, 2007, literally overnight, it brightened by a factor of a million. And that's because there must have been a blowout of gases and dust from the interior. It was like maybe a pressure cooker, and gases were building up inside without any fissure through which to escape. And then as the pressure finally became sufficiently great, the thing just blew apart, or at least the surface layers blew out. The thing did survive. And these surface layers got ejected and formed a gigantic coma around the nucleus. The nucleus is that little tiny thing right there. And this coma reflected a huge amount of light. So this became an unexpectedly good comet for a while, and Ison could do that. Will it break apart into several pieces? This could be good. If it breaks apart into several pieces without completely disintegrating, that's good because now you have more surface area over which gas outgassing can occur. and over which dust can be emitted. So we want it to break up into several pieces, but just not too many pieces so that it completely disintegrates. And Comet West 76, any of you see that one? Do you remember that one? Okay. Well, that one looked as brilliant as it was in part because it broke up into several pieces. So the point is, we can't tell. And famous amateur astronomer and comet hunter David Levy says, comets are like cats. They have tails and they do precisely what they want, okay? So we just don't know. And as an example, there's the famous comet Kohoutek, 7374. I was in high school, greatly looking forward to its appearance as president of the science club. It was billed as the comet of the century. How many of you remember that, right? Yeah, comet Kohoutek. Okay, not. Okay, it was a fizzler. Now, in fact, it wasn't that bad. In fact, it was barely visible to the naked eye, which among comets is among the brighter end of the distribution. And astronomers knew about it a year in advance, and they were able to study it. So it wasn't scientifically a fizzle. But compared to the huge press it had received, it was indeed a public disappointment. An example of that press, the comet cometh, you know, greatest fiery chariot of all time, you know, the world's most spectacular new comet has arrived. Is it a messenger of doom from outer space or a scientific clue to the birth of our universe? Well, not the birth of our universe, the birth of our solar system. It's a bit different. But in any case, you know, it was just a huge big deal, and then it fizzled, and most people came away quite disappointed. And indeed, even among professional circles, when you want to refer to a comet that ended up being a dud, you sort of call it a Kohoutek. And if I were Mr. Kohoutek, I would be a little bit displeased that my name is associated with things that fizzle, okay? Anyway, so we just don't know. Okay. All right. You're not going to see it probably before perihelion passage, but when should you look, assuming that it survives? Well, there are two competing factors here. When it's very close to the sun, say December 1st, it's still outgassing a lot. That's good. And it's also close to the sun, so it's got a lot of light to reflect. Inverse square law. That's good too. But it'll be in a very bright twilight sky, only visible shortly before sunrise. Contrast won't be very good. As it moves away from the sun, it gets into a darker pre-dawn sky. That's good. But it's moving away from the sun, so the outgassing rate will decline, and moreover, by the inverse square law of light, there will be less light to reflect. So there are these competing factors. From what I've read, the sweet spot should be around December 10th or 11th, plus or minus 3 days, something like that. So here's a simulation of what it might look like December 10th. And by the way, here it is where the nucleus, December 1st, is technically brighter than on the 10th, but it's in this very bright sky, and the tail gets washed out by the brightness of the sky, December 5th, December 10th. And then beyond the 10th or the 15th, it'll start fading substantially simply because of the distance effect. All right. The geometry near the date of observing, a date of best viewing, will be quite favorable. So here's Earth on December 11th, let's say. Here's Ison. And here's what the tail will be. So we are nearly perpendicular to the tail. That's good. You want the tail to be like this, not like that. The problem with Halley's Comet in 85 or 86 was that it was like this. And no astronomers predicted that Halley would be a bright, visually, you know, spectacular comet. I mean, much was made of it in the press. But astronomers knew of the poor viewing geometry, ages before it came. In fact, the next time it'll come is also a poor viewing geometry, 76 years after 1985, 86. But the next time after that will be a quite favorable viewing geometry for Halley's Comet. So if you live 150 years or so, you'll see it. Anyway, this is a favorable viewing geometry. So if it develops a long tail and sustains that tail, that'll be a good thing. And here's a simulation of what it might look like looking east before sunrise, all right? So what you should do is you should look east maybe 45 minutes to an hour, maybe 30 minutes before sunrise. If it's December 1st and you're looking an hour before sunrise, you won't see anything because it'll be up just a few minutes before sunrise. But by the 13th or 17th, it'll be up in the dark sky 30 minutes, 45 minutes before sunrise. So look toward the east, all right, and you might see it. Now, here's the simulation. What will happen in the second half of December? Well, it'll fade, but it'll head north, and it'll become visible in principle through a telescope or a good pair of binoculars all night. Because here's sort of a star chart. Here it goes cruising along, and then passes by the sun, and then it heads way over to here. And these are northern constellations, Ursa Minor, the little bear, Draco, the dragon. This is far to the north, so it'll become visible all night rather than just the early morning hours before sunrise. But it will have faded a lot by then. But if you have a telescope, you can look up the predicted coordinates and monitor it. So what's my prediction? My prediction is that Comet Ison will be a pretty good comet. You know, perhaps the best one visible in the northern hemisphere since Yakutake and Hale-Bopp in 96-97. But probably not as good as Hale-Bopp. I mean, if it's half as good as Hale-Bopp, I'll be pretty pleased. If it's as bright as Hale-Bopp, I'll be overjoyed. Probably not as bright, but I think still visible to the naked eye. Hale-Bopp was really a very, very fine comet that was easily visible for at least a month or so, even longer than that. Yakutake was a fine comet as well, but it moved across the sky very quickly, and so it was only at its prime for a few days. Anyway, so I think it'll be a pretty good comet. I base this on the historical precedent of Comet Lovejoy. Lovejoy should have disintegrated or could have disintegrated before reaching the sun or right at perihelion, but it did not. And so maybe Ison won't as well. It depends on whether this thing has sort of a tar-like layer around it. Sometimes these things have a layer of gunk on the outside. After the easily volatile materials have evaporated away, then there's sort of a layer of gunk that's kind of like tar, and it can protect the innards. So maybe that'll protect the comet from completely disintegrating. Maybe it'll become like McNaught. That is what I think is the best comet probably of the past 100 years, even though it's technically in the 21st century. Either that one or Ikeyasaki, 1965. This one you could see had many outbursts. See all these striations? These were from separate outbursts of gas and dust that went flying away from the head, formed this curved tail, and just was a spectacular sight in the southern hemisphere. I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to go to the southern hemisphere at that time. So anyway, probably not the comet of the century, but the suspense is killing me. The only way to know will be in a month or so to look. And there are two sort of extreme strategies you could take to observe it. You could monitor it every morning, you know, just morning after morning, December 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or just on one morning, look at the weather reports at around December 8th through 14th, December 10 or 11, plus or minus 3 days, and don't read any of the news reports. You know, keep yourself completely in the dark, so to speak, and then look at it for the first time on one morning. And if you do that, you might have an experience kind of like what I had with Comet West in 1976. I was a college student. I was busy with physics problem sets and stuff. I would typically be up until 2 or 3 in the morning, and then I would try to go to sleep after finishing these problem sets. And the trouble was Comet West was an early morning object, like 5 in the morning. Well, one morning I decided to get up and just look at it, and I had not paid attention to any of the reports. So I went outside, looked toward the east in a dark, moonless sky, and what I saw was just this spectacular thing, tail rising from the nucleus, almost merging with the Milky Way above, okay? And that was such a spectacular sight. I woke up my parents, and this was one of the few times they were actually grateful that I woke them up at 5 in the morning to look at the sky. So that was a fantastic experience, and I'll never forget it. And in part, it was because I hadn't been following it. But you might follow it. Those are two extreme strategies. In any case, good luck. I hope you see it. Use this as a chance, by the way, to excite your neighbors and especially our youth. I think our country is having real problems in stimulating interest in STEM fields. We're falling rapidly behind Asia and Europe in many areas in science and mathematics. So it's a good chance for STEM outreach. Organize maybe a comet viewing session in your local neighborhood. If you're in a brightly lit area, however, I would suggest you schedule at least one morning where you that morning drive to a distant dark location, or maybe go there the night before, stay at a Motel 6 or some other place, you know, go to, I don't know, Point Reyes or some other dark area. If you live in downtown San Francisco, you're probably not going to see it, okay? The darker, the better on at least one morning. So I hope you see it. And then one other note, I do a lot of my own research at Lick Observatory, and I encourage you to visit Lick Observatory. It's just a two-hour drive from here, and they might even organize some comet viewing sessions. But in any case, that's a reasonably dark sky from which to view the comet. Looking east, it's darker than looking west because you're looking out over the Central Valley, and the skies are reasonably dark. Or go to Point Reyes or the Sierras or something like that. But Lick is a cool place to visit in any case. And I'm president of a thing called the Friends of Lick Observatory. I'm president of the board, the foundation board, and I encourage you to join the Friends of Lick Observatory if you want to support all the research and student development and training and public outreach that we do there. And then one other final thing, occasionally I send out little updates on astronomy, not very often, but if you want to get those updates, you can send me an email at updates@astroalex.org, or you can take a photograph of this QR code. All right. And I think there's time for questions, right? So there we go. Thank you very much. Yes, now repeat the questions. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
You have to go on the microphone in order to be recorded for the thing.
Oh, cool.
And I'd like to remind our audiences that we are listening to Professor Alex Filipenko speaking on Comet ISON at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Now it's time for Q&A.
Great.
Thank you for your very fascinating lecture.
Thank you.
I've seen some digital video recently showing a big volcanic action on the moon Io.
Yeah.
And the speaker said it was related to a comet ISON. And then also he said that there had been a big, big dust storm on Mars, and it looked like there was some evidence of some volcanic activity on Mars. So the question is, have you heard anything about that? And more broadly, do comets ever affect planets or moons and volcanic activity?
Yeah, so I have no idea of how this could be possible. But I'm not an expert on that. But just thinking about the physics of it, I'm not sure who said it. Maybe they're right. But I'm highly skeptical that volcanic activity on Io had anything whatsoever to do with a three-mile-sized object, you know, many, many astronomical units away, okay? An astronomical unit being the distance between the Earth and the Sun. So if you could send me a link or something, I could look into this more. Similarly, there's no evidence for strong volcanic activity on Mars. There's occasional evidence for some of the permafrost maybe melting and forming a little tiny river going down, a little tiny stream going down the sides of a crater or something. And we definitely know that there's frozen water on Mars. Occasionally it might melt due to some geothermal or marsothermal activity, who knows. But again, no evidence of any large-scale major volcanic activity on Mars. Mars has been a dead planet for a very, very long time because it's a small planet and it radiated away its interior heat long ago. And so it doesn't really have a magma, you know, that can go through the surface and erupt. And if it were the case that it were erupting, again, I see no physical link whatsoever between that and Comet ISON. Now, do they ever affect things? They could affect things. I mean, you know, there was Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 in Jupiter in July 1994, which crashed into Jupiter, and it formed Earth-sized blotches. And it's these kind of events that illustrate the power of a comet that's hurtling toward a planet. You know, if one of these things, the size of Hale-Bopp, for sure, okay, were to hit the Earth, it would cause a mass extinction. And indeed, we think the Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction was either the result of either a comet or an asteroid hitting the Earth and obliterating, you know, two-thirds of all living species. So that can have a very adverse effect on life. But even a collision of that sort probably wouldn't cause, in and of itself, rampant volcanic activity. because a little thing hitting the earth sends up a big cloud of dust, but does not exactly change the structure of the mantle and stuff very much. So I don't even see how a collision of a comet with an Earth-sized object would affect its volcanism. Yeah. But it could definitely affect life.
Can you tell if Ison is has a rotation on it? And that might affect its whether it can hang together.
Can we tell whether Ison is rotating? It's probably rotating. I don't know of any such studies that have shown it. You would detect rotation through a periodic modulation of the brightness. That would be easiest to measure, and most it would be best to measure the brightness of the nucleus. Okay, because what the coma is doing won't really be affected very much by the rotation. Whereas the nucleus, if the nucleus is oblong or something like that, and the thing is rotating, then occasionally it'll have its broad side toward you, so it'll be reflecting a lot of light, and occasionally it'll be on end like that, so it'll reflect relatively little light. I have not read of any measurements of that sort, so my guess is that there's no obvious sign of rotation, or I would have read about it, but I don't know for sure that there's no sign of rotation. Certainly many asteroids have been found rotating in this way, yeah.
You say one of the benefits of comets is we can see this pristine material.
Yes, pristine material.
From long ago.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, what are we finding when we look at that pristine material, and what useful information are we getting?
Yeah.
And also, how do we capture the material? And
right.
And lastly, do we get comets from outside, far outside our solar system?
All great questions. So some of the things we're learning. One of the things we've learned is that a significant fraction of the water on Earth's oceans may have come from comets, okay? Probably not all of it, because the isotopic composition, the ratio of deuterated water to normal water is different in comets than in the Earth's oceans. But some significant fraction of the Earth's ocean water may have come from comets. Comets also have organic material in them, so some of the organic material on Earth may have come from comets. That's not to say that there are amoebas living in comets, but you can get organic compounds without actually having had any biological process, right? Methane, for example, CH4 is an organic material, but there are abiotic ways in which to produce it. Nevertheless, a source of such materials to the Earth may have had something to do with the development of life on Earth. We just are not sure. Your second question was, have we ever seen them from outside Earth, right? Outside the solar system. Yeah, that would be really cool. If we found one with a composition that was very different from anything that we found in our solar system, that might be one that escaped from some other Oort cloud into interstellar space and happened to impinge upon us. That should be rare, but not at all zero, right? In other words, there should be cases like that. I don't know of any so far where the composition has been all that unusual. And then you had a question, I thought, in between. How we capture, right. We can capture material by sending spacecraft to comets whose presence we know about long in advance. And so that's usually the so-called periodic comets, the ones that on their way in long ago got perturbed by Jupiter or Saturn or whatever into an orbit that's a fairly short period, 76 years in the case of Halley's Comet, 10 or 12 years in the case of other comets. So we know about them and we can plan spacecraft to them. So, for example, the Giotto spacecraft went to Halley's Comet. It's named the Giotto spacecraft because in one of Giotto's paintings, there was actually Comet Halley. If you look at, I forgot which of Giotto's paintings it is. But anyway, and there's been other comets to which we've sent spacecraft. And indeed, a spacecraft was even sent to a comet where it crashed into the comet. And this was tuned to occur on July 4th. You got to have a crash on July 4th. And, of course, material then was squirted out, and so we could study the inside of the comet by having fired this projectile at it. It was Comet Vilt 2, wasn't it? It's spelled like wild, but I think it's Vilt. Or was it a different comet that the thing was Yeah. And then there's been spacecraft that have passed sort of through the tails of comets and have collected the gases, you know, the little particles. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Any spectroscope analysis that tells you what's in the comet?
Yeah, there's a lot of spectroscopic analyses. So we've seen, for example, in comet Ison, the carbon-2 molecule very strongly. That's what causes that greenish color. If our eyes were more sensitive to blue, we would see it. In fact, in some of the pictures, you do see some blue. And that's caused by the cyanogen molecule, CN, which emits in the blue part of the spectrum. So CN has been found, C2 has been found, basically various carbon compounds. Water, of course, has been found, things like that. Carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hey, great talk.
Thank you.
I was most intrigued by this the comment you just made about how perhaps the water in the oceans may have been derived from an extraterrestrial or celestial body.
Part of the water, not all of the water, but part of it.
I was wondering if, for those in the audience who may not be familiar with the notion of deuterated, whether you could explain that concept.
Yeah, so I went over that kind of quickly. So hydrogen has three technically, but one of them is unstable. So call it two isotopes. By far the dominant form of hydrogen has a proton, a single proton, and then an electron kind of in a cloud around it. But hydrogen can also have a proton and a neutron. Okay, that doesn't change the charge of the nucleus. It's still hydrogen, but it makes it a different isotope, all right? And that's about a part per 100,000 in rough numbers, okay? But in detail, the abundance, the fraction of hydrogen that has at least one atom that's deuterium versus normal hydrogen, that fraction varies, and it's different for comets and water here on Earth, which means that all of the water can't be from comets, because otherwise it would have the same isotopic composition as the comets do. But we think that a significant fraction might be from comets, because the problem is that the early Earth was very hot, and the early oceans, if they even existed, would have vaporized and would have kind of evaporated away. And the molecules get going so quickly due to heating from the sun that they can actually escape from Earth's gravity. All right? Planets lose their atmospheres gradually, and they're replenished through outgassing. Okay, so some of the water was replenished presumably through volcanic outgassing. But it's thought that that might not have been enough to explain the oceans at their current average depth and stuff. And plus, we know that comets have water in them, and we know that comets hit the Earth and early in the history of the solar system while planets were still in the process of forming. Well, they formed by attracting the leftover debris. Jupiter became so big by swallowing tons of comets, basically, and it flung some of them out. So Earth grew by accumulating comets. You know, the process of growth would have meant that by design, some of the Earth's water came from comets. Okay, that's the idea. Yeah.
Next question.
Yeah, there's one over there.
A few years ago, they discovered that amino acids were on a certain comet, I believe. And just what's your opinion on the credence? How much credence do you give to the notion of transpermia, where comets seeded early life on Earth?
Yeah. Panspermia, the idea that comets actually had living organisms in them and seeded life on Earth. I think the probability is very low, because comets in our solar system and presumably other solar systems are primitive leftovers from when the planetary system was still forming. Okay, you might have some chemical processes that produce amino acids in those comets. But getting from an amino acid to life excuse me, is a huge step. And without having an aqueous environment, a liquid environment, it's even harder for chemical reactions to occur. Okay, and comets floating around way out there are basically frozen. So I just don't see the environment for building up anything that resembles life. I'm frankly surprised there's anything as complex as amino acids in them, okay? Shows how much I know. But there's a big step from amino acids to life. I mean, amino acids have been produced through reactions in laboratories where chemists have taken a vial of gases thought to be representative of Earth's primitive atmosphere. This stems from the experiments of Miller and Urey in the 1950s. Okay, and Carl Sagan did some of these as well. And they sent an electrical discharge through these gases, simulating lightning. Okay, and after a few days, they see that this brown gunk collects up in another flask down below. And sure enough, that brown gunk has some relatively complex compounds, including some simple amino acids. So you could call that the chicken soup, but how do you get from that to the chicken? That's a huge step. And, you know, biologists still have no idea of how exactly life forms. That's one of the eternal mysteries, and maybe someday it won't be eternal. But it's clearly a very complex process. It's almost certainly dependent on a liquid environment, or at least greatly favored by a liquid environment, and comets are just not that way. Now, it's possible that life first formed on Mars, for example, microbes and bacteria, and then some asteroid hit Mars, and, you know, chunks of rock go flying away, and some of those chunks land on Earth. We've found chunks that are undeniably from Mars and also from the Moon. Among some of the meteorites, some of them have a composition which is dead on what the Mars composition is and what the Moon is as well. And so those were chunks of the Moon and Mars that, you know, were blasted off and then landed here. So it's conceivable that life first formed on Mars, and then within one of these chunks deep inside, there were some bacteria and microbes. And by the way, they live way, way below Earth's surface. That's no problem for them, okay? And so they could be flying around through the solar system for millions of years and then land on Earth, and then life takes over, right, in this nice, hospitable environment. So that's possible, and if that's the case, we are the descendants of Martians. And so if we ever find life on Mars, that'll be very exciting, but I will want to see what the evidence is that that life was independent of life on Earth. In other words, did life form only once in the solar system and through a panspermia-like process spread, or did life form at least twice independently? That's a huge issue. Because if all of life in our solar system, assuming there's more than just on Earth, which we don't know, by the way, but whatever, you know, if it all came from one case of life forming, then we still don't really know how common it is. Whereas if there are two or three independent occurrences of life in just a region of space as small as our solar system, it greatly improves the odds that life might be really quite abundant throughout our galaxy and the universe. And when we only know of one case of life, it's conceivable that it's extraordinarily rare, and we are here thinking about it, not because it's common, but because, you know, we couldn't be on a planet where no life had ever formed, right? That's sort of it's a necessary condition for us to be participating in this Commonwealth Club activity, for life to have formed on Earth, right, and led to our existence. So you cannot simply, based on our existence, conclude that life is easy to form and is common, right? Rare things occasionally happen, but they're rare.
We have time for one or two more questions.
Okay, great.
You mentioned earlier on about the ISON group looking for asteroids,
yes,
specifically ones that were going to collide with Earth, and comets, presumably, as well. Could you talk a little bit about international cooperation in looking for them and what their success rate is, especially as the meteorite that hit Russia earlier in the year wasn't detected?
Yeah, well, that was a great wake-up call, that thing on February 15th of this year. It's amazing because there had already been a heightened sense of awareness because that same day, another one passed, you know, closer than the moon's orbit. In fact, closer than the geostationary satellites. And it was half the size of a football field. Had that thing hit the Earth, it wouldn't have been a mass extinction, but it would have caused what's called more than just regional damage, I would say. Depending on where it landed, it could have been civilization changing, you know, if it lands on New York City or, you know, something like that. Anyway, so I'm sitting there working late at night, and, you know, I get bored occasionally and just pop onto CNN, see what's going on. And this article, I see this article, you know, blast over Russia. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, this is 14 or 15 hours too soon, and it's the wrong part of the world. At closest approach, this thing was supposed to pass over Sumatra or something like that. And then I realized it's a different event. Do you remember that? February 14th, 15th? It was amazing. You know, we're all waiting for this thing that was definitely not going to hit. And then there's this thing that hit over Russia. And by the way, they were not related. They came in from completely different directions, all right? So that was a wake-up call. And, you know, already a lot of astronomers are looking, and the federal government is aware of this problem. And indeed, astronomers are funded in part by the federal government to find these asteroids, especially the big ones, because the big ones are easier to find, and they're the ones that create the most damage, all right? Mass extinction. That's a pretty bad thing. The smaller and smaller ones, well, they're problematic. They're hard to find because they're so faint. So we don't see them until they're very near us. On the other hand, they're not going to wipe out everyone, okay? So we do what we can. We should do more. There are a number of astronomers working on methods of detection. And so, for example, there's a foundation called the B612 Foundation, headed by former astronauts Ed Lu, Rusty Schweikart, various other people, who are designing an infrared detector to be launched on a satellite called the Sentinel Project or something like that. And it's going to find small ones much more easily with an infrared sensor than we can by looking at optical light. And the problem is this. When looking at optical light, we're looking at what's reflected from, you know, it's reflected sunlight. And a little thing doesn't reflect much sunlight. But these bodies are warm and they glow, and so they can be detected in the infrared when they're relatively small, maybe 100 meters or so, 140 meters. That's the goal. We need to find them as they're smaller and smaller and smaller. Something the size of Chelyabinsk, Russia, that was maybe 15 meters. We're nowhere close to finding those things and let alone doing anything about them, right? Because you can't just find it a day or two in advance, right? You have to plot the trajectory. You have to send something up there. You got to deflect it. That's all decades of work, or at least years. So what we hope to do realistically is prevent a global extinction or a civilization-changing event. Global extinction is sort of 10 kilometers and larger. Civilization-changing is thought to be 1 kilometer and larger. That's as long as it doesn't land. I mean, you could have a 100-meter thing landing on New York City, and that would be pretty civilization-changing given the interconnectedness of civilization now. But anyway, we now know about all of the 10-kilometer and above-sized ones, and none of them are heading our way. Doesn't mean some comet can't come in from the Oort cloud and do us all in, but the comets are only 1% as plentiful as the asteroids, so it's safer bets is to place your money on finding the asteroids, because we can do something about them, by the way. Comets coming in for the first time, you know, we only have 1 year warning. That's not enough time, okay? But asteroids, if you know 50 years in advance that this one is going to hit us, you just send a spacecraft up there, nudge it the tiniest bit, even use a gravitational tractor, you know, just tug on it a bit. By the time 50 years are up, it will have missed the Earth, okay? Because you need just the tiniest deflection. If the thing's about to hit you, you need a gigantic deflection, okay? And you don't have much time to plan. So the little ones, you know, we're not going to do anything about anytime soon. But the Sentinel mission might help, and there are other surveys being done through international groups like this that are painfully aware of the situation. That's why I'm saying astronomers plus applied physicists and engineers together may someday save humanity. But the little one that hits, like Chelyabinsk, I don't see that we're going to ever do anything about those.
Well, thank you very much.
Sorry, that was a long answer, but it's a very important topic, okay? Yeah. And as I put my stuff away, I'm happy to answer a couple of more questions, but yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 111th year of enlightened discussion.
All right, great.